Hi, everybody. Welcome. This is Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice, and I'm Terry Patton. And for anybody who doesn't already know who I am, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and Integral Soul Work, and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. This series was created to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating another contribution to our larger public dialogue about how higher consciousness can deepen and expand and play a role in helping us rise to meet our current challenges, to make as benign as possible a transition to a more sustainable presence on our planet. I've now held over 85 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I'll be joined by Cynthia Bourgeau, and we'll continue that discussion in a conversation we've titled The Eye of the Needle and the Cave of the Heart, Cultivating a Pure and Single Heart in a World Stuffed Full of Way Too Muchness. The way this will work is that I'll introduce Cynthia, and then we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions. So we'll finish up in about 90 minutes, or maybe just a few minutes more. Cynthia Bourgeau is a Christian mystic, an Episcopal priest, a writer, and an internationally known leader of contemplative retreats who has helped thousands of people to deepen in centering prayer. She's worked closely with Father Thomas Keating, Bruno Barnhart, Richard Rohr, as well as many other contemplative teachers and leaders, not just in the Christian tradition, but in many others. She's the founding director of both the Contemplative Society and the Aspen Wisdom School, and she's the author of 8 books, including her most recent, The Holy Trinity and the Law of Three, and also The Meaning of Mary Magdalene, The Wisdom Jesus, Centering Prayer, and Inner Awakening, and others. She divides her time between solitude at her seaside hermitage in Maine and a demanding schedule where she travels all over the world teaching. There are many things I deeply appreciate about Cynthia in person and in her writing. She really embodies a lot of diverse virtues. You know, first there's this combination of spiritual depth and intellectual acuity and vigor. She's a sophisticated modern and postmodern scholar, as well as a contemplative and mystic practitioner. And in that sense, she's something like a pandit. A pandit is both a scholar and a practitioner who integrates inner knowing with outer knowledge. And then she's also a serious contemplative and hermit who also walks the path of action and service. She's influenced thousands of people serving the contemplative awakening of people all over the world. Now, additionally, she's able to be a strong Christian and advocate for the riches of the tradition of Christian contemplative practice, and at the same time be a fierce constructive critic of the forms of stuckness and staleness of the churches and traditions and ways that it expresses itself, and an advocate also of practices that come outside her Christian tradition. For example, the latest book, The Law of Three, is about principles she learned from her years of study in the Gurdjieff work. I also very much appreciate her deep reading of the original and newly discovered lost gospels, and in doing so, I think she's really advanced contemporary understanding of what it is to contact Jesus's esoteric spiritual transmission and instruction in a way that's authentic and alive for people personally. I also appreciate that, like me, she's a creative participant in the evolution of a truly integral spirituality, deeply informed by the most profound dimensions of Ken Wilber's writings. And finally, I really like that she's regularly helping people find their way underneath the surfaces of mind and emotion and personality into the actual experience of contemplative mystical depth. And that is what I'm excited to be able to explore with her today. So Welcome, Cynthia. I'm really grateful and honored that you've chosen to join me today on this program.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's good to be talking again.
Yeah. Well, why don't we start by just talking about contemplative life? You know, this is really, it seems to me, the centerpiece of your life work. It's helping others and deepening in your own contemplative life. And it might actually be quite useful to ask the dumb question, you know, what is contemplative depth? And why does it inspire your passion and engagement in the way that it does?
Well, I don't think it's a dumb question at all. I think it's a very, very important question, because there's a outer contemplative and an inner contemplative. And most people who have heard of contemplative at all will tend to equate it with the outer, which is basically a lifestyle. And the understanding is a contemplative life is one where one goes to seek gobs and gobs of silence, living away in continuous prayer with God, pulling the plug on most of the attractions and the diversions of society as we know. And you have the pictures of hermits in caves and anchoresses like Julian of Norwich who elect to stay in their single little cell for their life. So it looks like an extraordinary vocation. And if you ask many people what was the closest synonym to contemplative, or the first thing that came up in their mind, they'd say silence. But that's the outer form. And without the inner form, the outer form is simply a silent show. It's kind of a mime show. But the inner form is really, the contemplative about life is about the transformation of consciousness. And by that, I'm not talking about what you think, but about how you think. A work, a rewiring and a re-kind of configuration of how the brain heart actually makes connections, how it actually sees the world. And what's going on beneath that external form of silence is the internal form of an adjustment of consciousness, and particularly our conscious attention, so that it's not being constantly dragged out to this, that, and the other kind of stimuli or issue in the world, and then reeled back in along the thread of a narrative of a personal selfhood. It's learning to develop what I think the generic name in the trade would be witnessing presence, but it's witnessing presence, which is really a whole new way of perceiving, a whole new perceptual hardwiring, so that you're seeing the world from different reference points. And once this is underway, then the conditions of internal or external silence are far less important. The external silence is really only important to pull the plug on the usual small self-evasions. We lose our energy in what's out and beyond us. And so the silence and the conscious moving inward is to learn to reverse that entropic flow of attention, and to begin to crystallize something else within. And once that's crystallized, then it's assumed that the very nature of the thing crystallized brings us into communion with the whole world and all sentient beings, and will impel us into courses of compassionate action.
Beautiful. You know, I'm... First of all, that was rather dazzling. You spoke very quickly, and there was a great deal of richness crunched into very few minutes in your reply just now. But having some deep experience with some of the things you're talking about, I'm hearing actually two things that, as you well know, Ken Wilber would distinguish, both. A profound deepening into an expanded state of consciousness, and also a growth into higher stages or structures, you might call them, of consciousness. And what you said about how one thinks and the way one constructs meaning, I would associate with the higher stages. Whereas what you said about witnessing consciousness and interior depth, and many of the things I know you've written about the contemplative life, which really have to do with communion, I would associate with higher states, and I think they're deeply intertwined in my own experience. And I'm you know, with Ken having recently discriminated them, and then hearing in your answer you speaking to both, I'm curious how you're holding that distinction and how, you know, not as an abstraction, but as it lives in actual practice and experience.
Well, for me, in my sort of simple-minded way, a state is a place you go to, a stage is a place you come from, and that a state, you know, there tends to be a classic confusion, at least in the Christian path, of mystical experience with unity of the seeing, and I think they're very different animals. That as Ken has pointed out, at any sort of stage of consciousness, you can touch the full state of mystical enlightenment, the full download, but you'll interpret it according to the stage where you come from. And for me, the nuance that, you know, I don't know, I haven't talked with Ken recently, so I don't know the degree to which he's working in these veins, but I certainly am, is that the graduation into all the non-dual states, as we at least as we experience it in the particular corner of the Western tradition I come from, requires what the Greek Orthodox call putting the mind in the heart, which looks like a metaphor, but it's actually, you know, physiology is supporting that what we really are doing is entraining the brain to the vibration of the heart, which allows the emergence of a perceptional field that sees from wholeness, that doesn't have to separate like the cognitive mind does in order to perceive and apprehend reality. So it's a completely different, if you want to call it, hardwiring of the system. And it's that, and I would say from the Western perspective, that alone that allows a mystical state to become a permanent stage of consciousness and is really the stabilization of the non-dual way of being in reality.
Yes, I resonate so much with what you're saying there. That was beautiful. This seeing from the whole was something that you brought forward when we did our dialogue a year and a half ago. And that principle of seeing, you know, I'm talking a lot about developing heart intelligence. And in my conversations with Ken on that topic, he's spent some time looking into it in terms of there really being three hearts, in a sense, the gross heart on the left that pumps the blood and that has a certain kind of intelligence that has to do with one's own health and well-being and empowerment, and then the heart in the middle, the subtle heart, the heart chakra, anahata chakra, that has to do with feeling and has to do with that sensation of love and that the way that the heart harmonizes the whole being. And it's, you know, very central. There's a lot that can be said about that. But then also a heart on the right, the heart that's centered at the sinoatrial node, the origin of the heartbeat, which is associated with consciousness itself, the causal dimension of being.
Yeah.
And it seems that there are different dimensions of heart intelligence that are associated with each of those three. And I know your work profoundly explores that heart on the right, not so much by talking about it being on the right, but talking about that radical consciousness. And yet there's an intelligence to all three hearts that in some way has some connectedness. They're not just three disparate, unconnected things. They all have some kind of continuity.
Exactly, and that's what makes it such a perfectly symbolic and actual vessel, because they are connected. You know, Robert Sardello makes that point very profoundly in his wonderful chapter in The Heart on Silence, the physical heart, the emotional heart, and the spiritual heart, as he calls these commodities, all overlap, all coexist in the same organism that's located in the gross physical body and makes us go around in this world and all worlds. And it's really the Sufi path, emerging from the 9th century dialogue, The Treatise on the Heart, by Joseph Al-Hamadan, that really sets forth the position that the heart is primarily an organ of spiritual perception, that its primary purpose in the human being is to keep track of those more subtle realms, and to dialogue with the life we're simultaneously living in particularity and in gross physical manifestation. So that's that's definitely the ballpark, and we do have a great swath of teachings in Eastern Orthodox and Sufism that developed this in the kind of upper left quadrant way of speaking that's classically that's traditional of religious insight and mystical vision.
Now, bringing our conversation back to the place we decided we were most passionate about having opened into this really profound territory, I'm curious about what you're noticing as you take people into retreat, help people deepen in their contemplative life. What are the obstacles or the process, maybe the landmarks along the path as people find their way into this kind of profound contemplative life, and this unwinding of superficial attention finds its way into the kinds of territories that we're talking about here. I'm curious, when you're looking at this in a couple of different ways, working as a person who's been a serious contemplative for decades and decades, working at a pretty profound level in your own self, and then working with maybe your most advanced students who might have been on the path for decades too, but then also working with new people. And mm-hmm. I imagine that some sense of the lived experience of finding one's way is beginning to show itself in a way that allows you to generalize with helpful comments that'll relate, to the many people that are listening to us are, of course, arrayed along that whole path. And yet there are probably some orienting generalizations that'll be helpful to everyone.
Well, let's see how I could work with this. And, of course, the major entry portals that people will come to me through are either Christians or heartbroken Christians, as I call it. The Christians are, the ones who are coming straight out of straight-up kind of church situations. And the heartbroken Christians are the ones who fled Christianity sometimes decades ago because they couldn't find the living water, and often have practices that, very mature spiritual practices that they've picked up in another tradition, but something in them is aching to come home. And so I would say there's slightly different issues with both of those groups. For people coming in from straight up exoteric Christian environments, the big problem is that there's virtually not a clue to what witnessing presence and witnessing selfhood is. That everything has been equated, the phenomenal self, the self in time, the egoic self with its endless narratives, is the self that Christianity, by and large, knows and honors and says, this is the thing that's going to, and die and be raised up and go to heaven where it continues to live its personal egoic life. So there's not a lot of sense of what we even talk about when we talk about witnessing presence. I used to have long conversations with Jerry May when he was alive, who's one of the very best of the Christian spiritual guides, founded the Shalem Institute for now for spiritual formation. And he simply couldn't distinguish. He thought whenever we were talking about witnessing presence, he was talking about he called it the self-image, egoic self-image. He thought it was that little egoic superego that stands up there and is constantly observing and commenting on you and telling you how you're off the path. And there was no sense of some deeper abiding selfhood. And I find that's pretty much a classic shortcoming of people coming in from the Christian path. They're contentious, they're narrative, they're very, very wrapped in their metaphors, involved with the stories of self, and very often coming from recovery work where the The whole idea is seen as the false self as your neurotic self and your true self as your healthy ego. So that's the problem in that contingency. And what you need to do is begin to stabilize attentiveness, spiritual attentiveness at a deeper place so they can actually begin to taste what this thing that's variously dubbed witnessing presence, or Thomas Keating calls it our spiritual awareness, so they can actually taste what that is. I think with the broken-hearted Christians and with so many that I find out in the spiritual but not religious marketplace, there's a general lack of understanding of what's to be held, what's there for them in that whole spirit in second person, as Kim calls it, devotion, the thou-ness of religion. And there tends to be, again, a preoccupation with the narrative self as the self that's actually going to transform, that the self that's actually going to achieve enlightenment or whatever the value is. And that tendency towards spiritual materialism, to collect experiences, to collect teachers, to drift from this one to that one, searching in some way for some kind of a baraka that will make them enlightened, without an understanding that the work is in the cave of your own heart.
I so recognize the second description, because, of course, that's more the world I teach in and work in. And I think that this focus on the cave of the heart is, it's interesting to me the different ways in which one finds one's way to that territory. That is, it seems that a certain period of preparation or purification is necessary in order to find one's way into that profound, more profound, you know, breaking the fixation of attention in the gross level, the waking state focus, so that there begins to be a sense, oh my God, it's the there's a wonderful phrase that I was recently taught by Dan Brown, who was a previous guest on this show, in his Mahamudra teachings, the out there-ness, that one orients to reality as if it's out there. And when one begins to discover that there's a dimension of reality, that even the out there-ness is a creation of, you know, what we might say, just looking at the universal cosmological principles that many teachers draw on, including Ken Wilber, the gross, subtle, and causal, that the unmanifest becomes manifest first through these levels of subtlety, and that in a way, even more real than our gross level experience or the source of how things come into being at the gross level is through the subtle and the causal. And this, when one goes into that deeper level of reality, instead of navigating as if I have no contact with the essence of reality inside here, I've got to go out there and make sure that I'm not going to get into trouble with something other, something outside me. But no, there's actually a deeper level, even that gives rise to all my world relational transactional experience, that's deeper in my interiority. And this letting go of out there-ness and a finding of contact with that deeper dimension of things seems to be a huge threshold. And although in our contemporary progressive spiritual world, we explore that mostly through non-dual teachings about consciousness itself, it really includes subtle experience as well, and soulful experience potentially. I'm curious as to how you're approaching that, because, you know, we can think of this more theoretically and kind of know what we know from having studied so much literature and all the great philosophies that have come together in this wonderful time. But there's another way we learn about reality, which is like the, you know, the early naturalists who just went out in the fields and drew pictures of what they saw or put pins through the butterflies and who actually just observed the phenomenal display. And having taught so many people, you've had a lot of that experience too. And I'm just curious to hear what it is that you're seeing helps people break that fixation and find their way from that habit of out-there-ness.
Well, the habit of out-there-ness is a direct function of using the, what I call the egoic operating system, the mind that perceives reality by separating the bits. And as long as you use that, and it's built deeply into the structure of the, you know, the brain, you're going to perceive reality as out there because it's the only way you're going to perceive it. And it's, you're going to perceive reality that way until something has grown and stabilized in you that doesn't perceive reality in that way, and then it's not a matter of anything you have to do. It's just you wake up one day and realize that when, you know, instead of closing your eyes or closing your ears when the other parts are singing row, row, row your boat so you don't get thrown off track, that the whole thing makes a chord and you can just open to the whole chord. So how you move to that kind of structure, you know, I don't spend an awful lot of time appeasing people in their various illusory progress along the, while they're still using separated consciousness. And I tend to put it backwards and say, you know, it grows in you incrementally. You start with a meditation. And that I think from the start, you know, people have these breakthroughs into profound unit of experience. I mean, even at the start of the simplest person who comes to a centering prayer workshop for the first day and does three periods of centering prayer not knowing what in the world they're doing, and then goes home and the next morning starts it again, what's happened? You know, there's something that has enough staying power from the inside that they go to the cushion and sit down again.
Right.
And I just kind of encourage people to stay with that and say that if you just stay with the practice, eventually it will change the way you see, and you see that all these things that you were fussing about and setting up as sequences and hurdles and steeplechases don't exist.
Mm.
You know, I don't think purification helps one bit in in getting toward the goal. I think rather that once you've had a taste of that divine other, purification is the practice. It's the kind of life path that most beautifully represents and syncs with what you've experienced, so that you don't take meat out of your diet if that's what you do in order so that you can have a more intense mystical vision. You rather realize that this capacity exists within you and that it's more easy to walk back toward it and stay in touch with it when you haven't laden your body up with all sorts of coarse substances, or that it's easier to maintain a sense of inner interiority if you don't start your morning with a morning TV show or the morning internet cruise. So these things that we would call purification practices, I think, are really the fruits of the awareness that's already there rather than the means to attain them.
Yeah, I think that's my experience too. It's when there's a real relationship to, well, the beloved, or we might just say open intelligence, you know, whether your orientation gives you those gifts in a more classically awareness mode or devotional mode, awakening or devotion.
And
yana,
there's no human being that does not come from the inside of the heart of what it's all about. So it's not like some people have gifts and other people don't. I mean, it's in there, or else you wouldn't be here.
Right.
So it's not a question of if. It's a question of how to cut through the layer upon layer of external conditioning and dysfunctional spiritual views that just hogtie you.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of Catholic seekers in particular that create this lethal combination of old Catholic shame and guilt, I'm not worthy, I'm no good, and that gnawing feeling that something very, very, very bad is going to happen to me, the place we're going to hell used to stand, if I don't make the mark in this life, and the mark that you have to make is you know, they pick up the concept of enlightenment, which is an Eastern term that has a whole different kind of philosophical milieu around it and the metaphysical and practice. And all of a sudden it becomes a race to enlightenment. And where can I go? And what teacher? And am I enlightened yet? And what's the practices? And, you know, and this frantic grasping that you could just sort of deride as spiritual materialism if it wasn't so desperate.
Mm-hmm. No, it's suffering that needs compassion.
It's
and
suffering
and
intensely,
help.
And my heart aches, and I look at people and say, you poor souls, go have a beer and a hamburger and come back. <You know? laughs> Tell me about the planet.
Yeah, really. and so you're seeing those kinds of things open up. So in a way, you're what I'm hearing from this is that in me asking for a naturalist's observation of what's
mm-hmm.
there in the space, you're really talking about simply creating a truly nurturing space in which the presence of the profoundly already okay, free, loving, awake silence is given a lot of space. And
yeah, it's accessible for the inside, and you realize that you can't possibly fall out of it. That
right.
That everything that makes you think you've fallen out of it is just this kind of separating processing mechanism you're using, which you can grow through if you're patient and trusting.
Right. Now, I'm curious to ask you about something that's been opening up in my own work. I've been recently, as I mentioned to you when we spoke just a few weeks ago, exploring soul work. And the way I would distinguish that from, you know, all of this is spiritual work, but for the sake of having, you know, simple language, we might contrast a certain kind of work in which we awaken, relax, open, find our way into the presence of God, the universal, the free, the true, the loving, the good, the joyful. There's a kind of expansion or ascent or relaxation, and yet there's another kind of mysticism in which one actually discovers something about what one next can do, like my particular path of expression, my unique
mm-hmm.
expression. And I've been contemplating how, in a way, the foundation of that larger spiritual work is for me, and that's really been the focus of most of my 40 years of practice, and it has transformed my whole identity and experience of being alive, and in a way that is, you know, clearly central to, you know, I can't imagine that anything else could be more central. And yet, life confronts us with choices that are not answerable from that universal wisdom. Do I move to this town? Do I take this job? Do I marry this person? Do I, you know, the very very particular things in which the deep knowing has to sense something in the incarnate field, and yet it becomes urgent that we make those choices from the deepest place we can, and recognize the truths that are at play from the deepest place available. And in a way, I think this is a dimension of subtlety, if we want to map it. You know, that the universal spirituality is ultimately framed by the true north of a non-dual vision, you know, and it's awake to all the dimensions of being, but in a way de-emphasizes the subtle so that we're not just drawn into content. Whereas this soul work is, if one's attention is disciplined enough and not constantly distracted by every little bit of non-ordinary information that floats in, can give us a way of listening with that ear of the heart to the particular call of spirit that's drawing us into our most important incarnate contributions and choices, you know, as we encounter them. And I'm curious how you hold these and how you'd respond to this.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the problem is getting tangled up with maps that I decided I don't use them. I'm aware of the maps, but because they don't really help the picture of how I immediately and viscerally experience life. I mean, I know theoretically what, you know, those subtle, you know, causal and non-dual are. That doesn't match with what I actually feel as I'm living my life, you know, that I really think that our consciousness is an umbilical cord between the finite and the infinite, and how I experience selfhood in this physical incarnation, which is really the only thing I have standing speaking about, is that I have a bell rack of selfhoods, you know, and they're all selfhoods, they're all expressions of this thing, and then they range from, you know, the most compacted and neurotic and conditioned to you know, a freer kind of thing, a kind of spacious, healthy ego, or to my higher witnessing presence. And often when I try and make decisions, what I will do, and it works remarkably well, is I'll pose the question and then I'll have a column for each of the four voices. I say, okay, weigh in, and I call one nafs. That's the Sufi term for that conditioned, passional, angry soul where you get all your false self, you know, programs. Then what you call soul, which is kind of the highest and cleanest voice of your self experienced as a created being. And then I have what I call my spirit. And then I weigh in with the fourth, which I call heart. And you can really tell the difference between each of these voices. And I ask each one what their take is on the question. And it's very, very interesting to see the responses you get. And I've learned patterns that work, and that I know that heart is in a deep way the third force between spirit and soul. And that as you learn to begin to listen through the heart, which for me is the shorthand for listening through the non-separated field, you get something which is both personal and yet spacious. And I think one of the problems with the maps are that the classic maps equate the personal with the lower levels of the things and say the higher you get up the transcendent, the more the personal drops out. I'm not sure that's true. But when you get the heart as the meeting ground of the personal and the spacious, and then you watch how the gamut of cells talk about any given issue. Do I marry this person? Do I move? It's a hilarious and wonderful. It's like getting all four bells going on a great bell banner on a Sunday morning, and you just laugh at the joy of what the human incarnated consciousness is capable of, you know.
I love what you just said, and I feel, you know, it's interesting, Cynthia. You're so smart, and you speak so quickly because, in some sense, you're so familiar with this territory. And yet, I think you're ringing bells that are ringing for me and for many other people listening right now, in a way that it might be good to resonate a while longer. So I'd like to invite you to circle back, and if there's something you're willing to share that you've asked those four voices, or if there's just an example that you might feel would be helpful to illustrate this with and unpack it a level deeper.
Well, I can remember one where, you know, a long, long tension in me was I going to, you know, I love to live in a snowmass, and I managed to live alongside the monks at St. Benedict's Monastery for many, many years, and then I went away to Canada and then came back and found a wonderful little place that I lived in during the winter, and then came out to my hermitage on Eagle Island in the summer. And at one point, you know, out of the blue, my landlady calls up and basically says, you know, you either need to rent the house for 12 months of the year in Colorado, or I'm going to put it on the market and find a full-time renter. So it's like the classic, you know, Fisher cut bait moment. So I sat down and listened to all of them, and the smaller self was saying, you know, grab it, grab it, grab it, you know, and I could see that this was just the grab it, grab it, grab it. That was the fear, the security, survival programs. The soul said, oh, I love Colorado, the mountains, you know, my spiritual teacher was here, all the memories that I've lived that just are me. Spirit says, what's this grabbiness coming from? And who needs it? You know, why are you doing the, you know, why are you hanging on to last year's language? So it hit a high bitch spark, but it was one a little bit beyond what the other two bulky characters could sustain.
Mm-hmm.
And then I listened to Heart saying in a very, very gentle way, you know it moves on, you know you will be taken care of, and it just quietly said, don't take the house. And it emerged out of the, you know, I could see by just laying these things out on the ground, I could see with my mind that most of the things that were making me jump to take it immediately had to do with either, you know, real false self, small self, security programs, or nostalgia. And
right.
Spirit knows that nostalgia is a suspect spiritual value. It always leads you into attachment and self-pity and despair and clinging and all that kind of stuff. But ooh, it feels so like you. And the heart position, which always has a kind of funny way of just sort of shooting the tube between spirit and soul, was able to acknowledge the goodness and the love that I had felt for these marvelous blessed years, and how much of my finite life had been tied up in this little mountain valley in Colorado, and acknowledge that was good and hold it, and still kind of quietly and gently reassure me that when you actually have to live the spiritual path, you don't get anywhere when you go backwards of what your highest truth really knows. And it just came in as a clear kind of mediator of what the highest truth in the situation was.
Yeah, beautiful. That's really vivid and helpful. You know, I worked fairly extensively with the folks at the Institute of Heart Math for a number of years, and I actually was the project manager for developing their first heart rate variability monitor. And the thing that I especially appreciated was that they did this very, very similar formal process. It wasn't, you know, drawn into those four levels so clearly, but it really did have to do with asking the heart one's questions. And the discovery continually was that the heart did not take the bait. The heart wouldn't get drawn into the dilemma. It would notice the fundamental okayness in being and not come from that place of problem and dilemma and anxiety that otherwise so distorts our intelligence.
Exactly, exactly. And you can set it up in what you can set it up in one of my law of three triangles with, you know, spirit and soul are affirming and denying, just coming to impasse. And heart comes in from a new place, and what it brings in, and the Sufi and the Orthodox traditions have so strongly re-emphasized that you develop heart as an organ of perception, but what it brings in is this spacious purity and a sense of the unity that allows the two that were just coming to impasse to meet in a new way, and a new possibility will arise out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, something did arise out of it in the case of the house. I reluctantly gave up, you know, signing the lease on, you know, on this little place that I thought was going to be my home in Colorado. And not 2 weeks later, I found myself sitting in a real estate agent's office in Stonington, Maine, with this incredible little place that had just essentially dropped into my lap, which which met all the needs that I thought that I was going to, I was clinging to for dear life, in trying to hang on to the my last year's language place in Colorado.
Right.
There it was, but it was on terms that were free and clear and empowering and doable, and it was just, it had this cleanness. I said, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I know that.
Well, you have to let go of what's already in your hand to receive the gift that's arriving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the heart brings the capacity to do that, you know, and letting go is not renouncing, it's just widening space, and you're not gripping the thing by its throat.
Yeah. You know, I think I've been using soul in a somewhat different, you know, to mean something slightly different. It's a word that's used so widely. We can get into all kinds of semantic conversations about it. But I'm actually more interested in the heart, in what you're calling the heart, and the cave of the heart, and the heart of the heart, and the you know, that process by which we can drop in, and even that I'm dropping in right now and listening, certainly with my intelligence, with my mind, but especially with that feeling quality that is really tender and open and almost childlike and ready to notice what might never have been noticed before, and is tender and willing to be astonished by the sacred and to be drawn deeper than that quicker vibration, quicker frequency of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
That process is so central to my inner life, and obviously you're someone who's been helping serve that discernment, that drawing into that heart of the heart, and maybe the chamber where it can hear and listen, and that voice can find its way forward. And I'd love to hear you elaborate on that whole process, on how it's served, on what it's like, on what the key virtues and strengths and almost the inner moves that we need to make in order for that to really become the center of our where we're living from.
Well, if I had to start really practically, I would just start with a strong plug for my my sponsor, Centering Prayer, and the teachings of Father Thomas Keating. And I don't know to the extent when he really got the practice of centering prayer kicked into life now 45 years ago or so, that he was, you know, that he had exactly foreseen and predicted all the consequences of the way that he would develop the path. But essentially, you know, it's almost the meditationless meditation. Because virtually everybody thinks that meditation is a matter of learning. You start with single-pointed focus. You learn to concentrate your attention on a single point, and only after you've mastered that do you move on to the witnessing presence and the Dzogchen objectless awareness. Centering prayer works with letting go of objects of your attention. They're called thoughts in centering prayer. When you catch yourself thinking, you let the thought go. So practically what you're doing during the whole time of centering prayer is releasing your attention from an object-attached state to a nanosecond of objectless awareness, and you're also learning that letting go of what you're clinging to, it's getting imprinted right in not only your basic spiritual attitudes, but your neurology as well. And, you know, I think there's data from the HeartMath Institute that kind of corroborates that non-constricted attitude really sort of profoundly influences the kind of channels that open up in the brain to perceive situations. So I would say, and this is really ridiculously simplistic, but I don't think it's falsely simplistic, that everything I've actually come to know, I've come through about 30 years of practicing centering prayer and letting that repeated, slow, letting go-ness, falling into those moments of objectless awareness and moving beyond them, it gradually brings about a capacity to remain in the cave of the heart and to begin to see from where the heart sees. And as that happens, your attachment to the personal self, whether it's the true self or the false self, they're both just versions of the same damn separation, it all eases, and it's okay simply to be there. And as you begin to open out to that, the classic Christian teachings say that blessed are the pure in heart, which means the single or the non-co-opted, for it shall see God. It shall see the things that are spiritual and subtle. So as you learn that letting go attitude as the way of restoring purity of heart or the unbroken field, then you begin to see from that wholeness. And I see it as an entirely incremental practice, but as it begins to happen, everything shifts. And so many of the practices that so many people I see working at by such hard, effortful paths come slowly over time just by the fruits of living out of this profound letting go-ness worked into every cell of your body. Are you there, or did we lose you?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh.
I had to clear my throat, and I muted the line and forgot to unmute. I was just speaking from the heart to you there.
Well, that would be a priceless moment in the interview.
There we are, yeah. Well, maybe it was the silence that we were talking about coming forward to claim its space.
Carrie thought mute with wonder.
Well, you know, I was just appreciating that you really let us in to your practice and to the quality of grace that finds its way through when we find, you know, and it's interesting, this purity of heart is It refreshes itself in unique ways in each new moment. You know, there really is no formula for the things that matter most, and yet we can speak of them. But then, as soon as the mind reaches out to grasp and hold them, and to know then how to reliably achieve them, they disappear immediately.
So it's simple, and I don't know that I understand centering prayer like anybody in either the Contemplative Outreach Network or Thomas or anybody, but I do know that how I've come to understand it has been a profound and life-transforming gift in my own practice.
Do you also do verbal prayer?
Oh, sure.
And is that a... Like, I've found after years and years of actually turning my nose up at even the word prayer, because, of course, what I was doing, even though it was quite a lot like what you call centering prayer, you know, I called meditation, and feeling that there was something kind of inherently dualistic and petitionary and divided and superficial about prayer, you know, I've come into having a very rich prayer life, including verbal prayer, because there is something in that turning to the mystery as my most primal relation, you know, always with me.
Exactly, and it emphasizes the thou-ness of everything, the relationality, and it is the song of the selves at those, you know, at the soul and those levels, and to be able to turn and to say, help, to be like Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof, and to see all of life being lived in dialogue with a God that listens. It's a convention, but it's a useful convention. Beautiful stuff emerges from it.
Mm-hmm. And to me, it's turning my attention to the utter mystery. I do not know who I am praying to.
Yeah.
I do not feel like I know how to pray. In effect, I jump off the cliff every time I dare to do it.
Yeah.
I'm in the unknown. I'm in free fall.
Yeah.
But I'm my heart is turned to the very source of wonder and grace, the very source of my own intelligence, the very source of love. And but see, talking about it isn't it. You actually have to do it. And
it's
a different act in each moment. You just have to show up and do it.
And of course, the great thing of all is when you can do it in a group. We were with a wonderful group of Jirahi Sufis last weekend in a retreat we were doing, and to have 50 human beings raising their voice together, singing Allah and Mercy, and it creates that power of synergy as all the individual streams of our yearning that are so often kind of kept inside us like little fish bowls by our skins, the rivers just flow into one great river of the common human heart. And I don't see how it's easy to touch that experience without vocal prayer and shared vocal prayer.
Mm. One of the things that I do with, particularly with people who are not much used to praying, is mm-hmm. creating a sacred circumstance and entering into prayer myself, you know, making myself vulnerable, letting my own heart speak. But for me, it's very important when I do this, not for the prayer not to be known words. I have to actually arrive not knowing what's going to come out of my mouth next in the present moment and be enacting this jumping off the cliff. And then I invite people to do that in groups where they actually do that in the moment with others listening. And it's been an incredibly catalytic practice for people. Many people have told me that they really didn't know what second person spirituality was until they did that.
Yeah.
Well, Cynthia, in wandering through this territory, I'm feeling that you're in your home court in a beautiful way. But one of the things that I notice about you is you're just so darn intelligent that your attention is always drawn to something new, and that even as satisfied, as richly held as you are by your actual contemplative life, there's something or other on the horizon. There's something intriguing you. There's something that you're curious about. And I'd love to hear what that is.
Well, at this point, the bulk of my own kind of interest and efforts is to really sort of reclaim the Christian the stake and the mystical edge of emerging philosophy, evolutionary consciousness philosophy. I've been working with the teachings of Teilhard de Chardin a lot with our groups, and watching and sensing that as science does move us to a larger and a much more dynamic view of the universe, that Christianity for the first time really comes alive. It never worked well as a static, staid religion. And while a lot is going on out in the world, that makes it look like classic institutional forms of not only Christianity, but many of the religions are in deep, deep trouble, still, I think that something inside is glowing very, very brightly, and I'm trying to attune to that with my advanced students. I've been working a lot in what I call thin place retreats with my senior students. That's, these great times in the Christian year, like one we've just gone through between Ascension and Pentecost, when, on Ascension, Jesus was supposed to have left the planet in bodily form, and then there was 10 days of waiting before the Holy Spirit showed up. So if that ain't liminal space, I don't know what is.
Mm.
So we've been really exploring these kind of liminal places that really liturgically and meditationally and imaginally are between the realms, to see if with a certain kind of refined attention we can kind of listen into and live into these places and feel our way back out from the center of what already is into how we're living it now.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. Well, I want to keep talking, but it is 11 o'clock, so I'm going to make a couple of important announcements while I invite people. If you'd like to ask a question and you're on the phone, please press star 2. And if you're listening through your computer, you can ask a question by typing it into the window. First, I want to make sure you know how to find out more about Cynthia's work. You can read her wonderful books, The Holy Trinity and the Law of Three, The Meaning of Mary Magdalene, The Wisdom Jesus, Centering Prayer, and several others. Cynthia is also the principal teacher and advisor of the Contemplative Society, which is the inclusive nonprofit association that she, I think you founded it, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Helped
found it, yeah. That encourages a deepening of contemplative prayer based on the Christian wisdom tradition while welcoming and being supportive of other paths. And they constitute, they support a worldwide community of fellow contemplatives encouraging consistent and balanced path for spiritual growth and transformation rooted in prayer, silence, mindful work, and the 1,500-year-old wisdom tradition of Benedictine hermitage. So you can go to contemplative.org, the Contemplative Society, and find many resources, including Cynthia's teaching schedule, a list of many articles by her, and links to several others of her writings and audios. I looked there yesterday, and I looked at the upcoming events, and I did notice two upcoming live retreats with Cynthia that appear to be open for registration. One of them is going to be very soon, June 20th and 21st, the Summer Institute at the Well in LaGrange, Illinois. And she'll be teaching with Diarmuid O'Muirchead. And then July 4th through 6th in Ireland, she'll be doing a contemplative retreat in the wake of St. Brendan. And you can find out more about all of that at contemplative.org. Additionally, I want you to be aware of some of my own offerings. As my inner life has continued to deepen, I've been listening, as I was saying, you know, not only to God, the universal divine source of love and goodness and sacredness and silence and the mystery beyond description, but I've also been learning to trust and listen at new depths to the voice of my own soul. I've long recognized that there can seem to be two kinds of mystical practice, one that opens beyond self into love and freedom, and another that surrenders into the depths of the psyche and into the natural world, the soul of the natural world, one's own personal soul nature. But recently, as my own practice has taken a more soulful turn, many new understandings about the relationships of these two dimensions of mystical life have been clarifying for me. So I've begun writing and teaching about it, and I call it integral soul work. Earlier this year, I decided to share this work with two small circles of students, and if you're interested to learn more, I invite you to go to integralsoulwork.com. You can sign up and get a free download of a 75-minute talk with which I introduced these groups some months ago at integralsoulwork.com. You're also invited to experience integral soul work with me in person at a 5-day workshop embodying the intelligence of your heart and soul, which I'll be teaching at beautiful Esalen Institute in Big Sur, August 17th through 22nd. I recently taught a 4-day workshop on integral soul work in Freiburg, Germany, and something really beautiful and deep and miraculous occurred. It seems like a magical time in this work, so you're warmly encouraged to join me for that. You can find out more details about that and my other work by going to terrypatton.com. You can also sign up for my mailing list. If you click events, you'll find out more details about Esalen and a link to the registration page. Okay, let's look at our questions. Well, let's begin with a live caller. I have somebody whose phone ID is as M. Marthaler in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Mike Marthaler. Actually, I'm up in beautiful, rainy Toledo, Washington.
And, okay.
I only caught the second half of your program, but I just wanted to thank you. I've been kind of following you over the years, that you acknowledge that this is a changing process, that your view has changed, your understanding changes. And so, again, I just wanted to thank you for acknowledging that. It's been, you know, sort of a thing with me over the years, that where I'm at today isn't where I was yesterday, and I don't have to just stay where I was. So thank you, and to your guests also. I'm sorry I didn't catch the whole program.
Sure. Thank you. Lovely to hear from you, Mike. Well, we have a lot of people who've typed in questions. Actually, I'm now scrambling to see if I can screen them adequately, even while I pay attention to what you say. I'm doing a little attentional juggling, I guess. Sarah from Machiasport.
Machiasport.
Okay, Machiasport. Thank you. She asks if you'd speak a little bit about your feeling about the place of ecstatic practices like trance dance, repetitive chant, and other practices that lead to an altered state of consciousness, especially in a communal setting. My own sense is a longing for this kind of celebratory ritual to be a complement to silent meditation. I feel a need for celebrating what I experience in silence and solitude.
Yeah, well, I think, yes, I would say here, that's quite true. I have a little bit of trouble with the whole phrase of this as leading to altered states of consciousness, and then I would ask the question, why? And who is the one that wants to experience other states of consciousness? I think ecstatic expression is a part of this great wealth of repertory of beauty and expressiveness that human beings have been given in their incarnate rich relationship with worlds visible and invisible. And what draws me most is, I think, kind of the ecstatic ecstasy of, particularly characterized in the Naqshbandi Sufi practices, where your soul can be deeply in the most riveting, highly intense divine communion. And yet at the same time you're standing at the counter in your bakery and counting out the change for somebody who has bought a loaf of bread and totally present to them. And to me that's the kind of ecstasy that I really think is the mark of the mature human being, to be able to bear the beams of love, as William Blake spoke to it, without it clawing our sockets. And I think there was a time, particularly in the 60s, when we sought mystical and ecstatic experience just as a way of either escaping the burden of our own finite consciousness, our own finite selfhood, or attaining to kind of hyper-realistic experiences which we imputed were more real than ordinary ones. And I find those are really inadequate motivations. But as we learn to stand in that firm, simple, clear, grounded ecstasy, then we can become like the bush that burns and is not consumed, and the fire glows from without us, from within our heart and around us to light up the world without destroying its recipient.
Mm. And you do a fair amount of this kind of thing in when you lead retreats.
Yeah, we do it, but I wouldn't call it ecstatic dance or ecstatic praise, because it puts the emphasis on the wrong thing. It's just praise. It's a way of giving thanks. It's a way of expressing and bearing gratitude. That one of the things we human beings are capable of doing is putting the weight of our own beautiful, simple, grounded, coarse physical existence against the weight of the ecstasy, against the weight of that divine that wants to touch everything, and in that way creating a perfect balance in which something can manifest. And I think if you if you seek the ecstasy too directly, what you get is, you know, deconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can learn to hold your own, and I think that a lot of our lower self is actually for this, then you become bearers of the light in a very, very lucid and sober way.
Mm. Beautiful.
I've watched the Sheikh, you know, a Sheikha that we were with last weekend. She can gently lead the group into an ecstasy of prayer, but as the Sheikha, she's the post holder. And she has to also be able to lead the group down so that they can go home at night without crashing into telephone poles. And it's the ability to manifest the experience without getting lost in it that I think is the real badge of freedom.
Mm. Lovely. Well, looking at the questions, a number of people had a little trouble hearing you. Maybe the mic has a little muffliness, and they, I think, didn't get the word NAFS, N-A-F-S, which
yeah.
means the kind of the egoic tendencies of the thing that one does battle with on the spiritual path, in a sense, the thing that you might say the lower.
Yeah,
self.
In the Sufi tradition, it describes what's called the lower passional soul. That is to say, the created being in the delicious sway. Of its programs, its passions, its dramas, some of its conditioning, some of its temperament, the soul that's metal to metal all the time. You know, there's no space for detachment or witnessing presence. It's all action reaction.
Mm. So, several other people wanted you to repeat those four voices, maybe more slowly and carefully. There's the NAFS, the healthy self or soul, the spirit,
yeah.
and then the heart, as I remember.
Yeah, that's how I do it. And I use NAFS. You know, I'm sure that different Sufi teachers would really challenge hard, well, what's the difference between the NAFS and the soul? But the way I do it when I just set up my little schematic is to define as NAFS the ones that's the most frenzied and automatic and conditioned and dramatic. And the soul would be closer to what I would gather you mean by soulful integrative work, the soul work, the most spacious, finite container you can be.
Mm-hmm. It might be helpful to unpack exactly how to discern each of the voices. We have several questions that relate to that. Ursa in Switzerland, for instance, typed in, can you say more about how to discern the voice of the heart? But I think maybe speaking all of that more slowly and carefully would be helpful to some of the listeners.
Well, when you discern, or at least when I discern, I listen in my body. And when I'm listening to what the NAFS has to say, you know, you can go immediately to the place of constriction, and the voices that immediately jump in speaking, and you'll hear tones of emotion in there, anger and fear and rage, and you'll feel in your body constriction. Soul relaxes it. Spirit is something you get used to listening. You get used to listening to. I would say that I start with meditation. And when you come out of meditation and are in a somewhat quiet and ordered state, not immediately hopping up to do something, there's often a clarity of knowingness that comes to it. And you can ask yourself anything at that place, and you'll get basically a quantitatively or qualitatively higher take on the same situation than you would if you came in your full flaming reactivity. And heart is subtle, because I think before you can distinguish the voice of the heart, you need to have kind of attuned to the voice of the heart, either through the kind of spiritual practice I've talked about, the heart practice that allows you to move into the space of the heart, which is really an operating system. It's a holographic field of perceiving reality. And you get to know it just by its kind of spacious and holographic, unboundaried nature. But it still has much more. It's got a twang. Sort of the difference between soul and spirit speaking is kind of the difference between a flute playing and an oboe playing. You know, and they're often making the same music, but they have a distinctly different timbre to them. And you learn that from just being in the heart and hearing how your heart speaks.
Yeah, beautiful. Let's take an in-person question from Maura Collins in Escondido. Welcome. Hello? Okay. Maybe.
Terry?
Yes.
Oh, okay. This is Lauren Palmer calling from Boston. I'm calling on a computer, so it comes through Google in California. I'm so honored to be on this question period with Cynthia and yourself. I have a question regarding working with the NAFs. Now, there's the idea of destroying the NAFs or somehow vanquishing them is contrary to a shadow work that the Tibetans use called chud practice. And in this case, you turn towards the demon and feed the demon until it's completely satisfied, rather than destroying them. Because if you destroy them, it's like trying to kill the Gorgon. Hercules whacks off a head and 10 more appear. Or it was said recently, when we kill one Taliban, 10 more suddenly appear. So the idea of doing shadow work, which would be working with the NAFs, is to actually acknowledge them, get them on your side as an ally, rather than trying to destroy them. And I was wondering what your take on that would be.
Well, my take is that I think the greatest single blight on Western spiritual practice has been this idea of spiritual warfare. And the whole idea that it comes up in the path, you'll find it in a level of the Sufi path, you find it certainly in the Orthodox path and in the Catholic Church, but the idea that the smallest thing is an enemy. And the idea that what you have to do, you know, even in centering prayer, you hear about melting or deconstructing the false self. I don't think that kind of aggressive approach works. I think it's a very, very bad picture, and you can't possibly create inner peace by inner warfare. So with that, I'm 100% in the same camp as the place you raise your objection from. For me, it's not so much getting your demons on side as recognizing that there's no you to get the demons on side with. That the psyche, you know, that a lot of the shadow work works at the level of soul work, and it still recognizes this person, this higher person, this ego, this consciousness, this unique self who's managing the shadow side. I think the beauty about moving more and more into the heart-generated sense of selfhood is that you realize there is no selfhood, and that these things therefore don't either have to be cajoled or destroyed. They can simply be allowed to be without tangling with them. You know, they don't serve anymore as the source of your motivators, nor are you feeding them energy by trying to repress them. So I like the kind of always moving towards greater equanimity through the process of having less and less of a self to stick out there and attract the messiness.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you for your question, and thank you, Cynthia. There are a couple
great questions. Very good question.
Yeah, wasn't that a great question? Here's a question from Janice in Victoria, B.C. Do you have advice for someone practicing centering prayer who does not have a clear spiritual belief system, having lost previous beliefs as a dark night of the soul? How can this be authentic when you want to practice but can't use words like God?
Oh, well, it's easy. I mean, that's how I got into centering prayer, because it didn't require you to have a belief system. The practice is merely idiot-proof. If you just follow the one little instruction, when you catch yourself thinking, you let the thought go. And a thought is defined as anything that draws your attention to a single point. So if you just practice that over and over and over again, what you begin to discover, or at least what I discovered, and I think it's sort of paradigmatic for a lot of people, is that that letting go action that they call in centering prayer language consent builds trust. And you can feel yourself becoming much more trustworthy, much more trusting of the cosmos in general, and less sort of protected and defended against things that can hurt you, including belief systems. And when the level of trust builds, then the final step upon that is belief. And then you can, then because you're not so constricted and you're fighting for your life against all these things that so often in organized religions just want to take you over and co-opt you into their systems, then you're able to understand that belief is not a system of coercion, but a set of covenants that you're going to use, that you can personally choose, to frame your relationship with that invisible, intimate belonging that you're a part of, that you've already begun to experience namelessly and creedlessly in the heart of your hearts. So I would say just go forth, and if you don't want to use a word like God, use a word like here, or let go, or now, or deep, or any kind of what I call state words that convey for you moving from that state of greater constriction to greater openness and release. And as you just do the process, it will gradually build your tolerance and also your sense of your own sure-footedness in beginning to navigate that tricky terrain of belief.
Beautiful. Thank you. I love that answer, Cynthia. Joan Hooley in Edinburgh, Virginia says, I'm on a waiting list for a Cynthia Bourgeau-facilitated November Wisdom School, and I find a dialogue within myself of opposing thinking about whether to proceed. On the one hand, the sense that the student is ready, that when the student is ready, the teacher appears, and I need not push the envelope. On the other hand, the thought that if I don't assert my interest by frequent inquiry on my status, it may be assumed that I'm not terribly interested, and I am. As I listen to this conversation, I see the small self in the latter and the heart self in the former, but maybe that's not very practical. Any thoughts?
Good work with the paradigm that I've laid out today. That's exactly right. To be able to distinguish between the voice that's grasping and fearful and has a story in the mind that, you know, the when the teacher's ready, the student, you know, when the teacher's ready, the student will appear. Just to talk about the November School, everybody is being closely watched. There's a long waiting list, and it's a very great specialty school. But we're also paying attention to the fact that there are a lot of people in exactly the same situation, and there's active work in place already going on to create a larger introductory wisdom school in November of 2015 in North Carolina that will get a lot more people in the gate, and also we're working to make use of some media resources and other things. So the need is registered, and you're not going to fall off the list. It's not going to be assumed you're not interested, because we assume that everybody's on the list is interested. And that's respected. So it's all part of fun to be part of a breaking wave of people that are so interested in reclaiming this kind of path that, you know, you're racing to get, you know, to keep up with the demand. And I haven't wanted to jump into this big kind of wholesale franchising things and just put it out there and have retreats where you have 500 people come, because it's I think something gets lost in that quality. I would just say that keep on doing the work you just did in the telephone call. And, you know, when the brass ring comes around again, think how much readier he'll be. It's great, but the spirit is your teacher, and in due course of time, you'll find the teacher has manifested in yourself.
Beautiful. Janaki in Boulder asks what I think might be a beautiful last question. She asks, if you would please tell us more about your exploration into liminal space. Where do we look to study and read?
Well, what's the big fly in the ointment of this question? Where do we look to study and read? Nothing has ever been said about studying and reading. The way to explore liminal heart space is really to enter the cave of your own heart. And as you do that, you become connected with people that, the people that will emerge into your life that are also asking that question. You know, I could give you a quick, you know, sort of bibliography of things, but one of the great losses in the path, and it really has given the wisdom path the bad name of Gnosticism, is when you get thinking that sort of subtle spiritual experience, when you confuse that with esoteric information. Liminal space is not information. And it's as close to you as your own heart breath. And any wise teacher in any tradition, as you begin to talk with that teacher and share heart to heart what your experience is, will be able to guide you towards the more subtle dimensions of spiritual unfolding if that teacher observes a readiness in you to actually enter that place experientially. And until then, knowing an awful lot about it doesn't do an awful lot more good than just make you look like you know more than you do. Myself included.
Yes, that's the soul of teaching is learning. Well, thank you so much, Cynthia. You're just so clear and powerful, and it's an honor and a pleasure. I'm really grateful you took this time to be with us. There are a few reminders. If you're interested in learning more about Cynthia's work, please visit contemplative.org. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it, and they can register for the series at beyondawakeningseries.com. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com and sign up for my mailing list, and also to find out about my August workshop at Esalen. And if you're specifically interested in learning about integral soul work, you can download a free 75-minute teleseminar at integralsoulwork.com. And coming up on Beyond Awakening, I'll be interviewing the world-famous philosopher of science, Irvin Laszlo, in 3 weeks on Sunday, July 6th. And then on July 24th, I'll be interviewing cell biologist Bruce Lipton on transforming human culture via neurobiology. Let's open up our lines so that we can hear each other's voices as we say goodbye. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you, Terry.
You're welcome.